OWC Radio 2.0, episode number 25, a fun conversation with Gareth Prosser. Hey everyone, Tim Robertson here, OWC Radio. Thanks for downloading. I really do appreciate it. Love if you wanted to send some feedback our way. It's owcradio@maxsales.com. And of course, you can always see the show notes at blog.maxsales.com. We always have some really good stuff up there on the blog. I hope you're checking it out. Right now, as a matter of fact, we've got a hot read about the iPod Classic. You know, Apple kind of canceled, well, they didn't kind of, they did. They canceled the classical line of iPods. And now this, for whatever reason, this holiday season, they're blowing up online sales everywhere I look, on eBay, on Craigslist, and people are snatching them up. It's a huge holiday gift for people this year. It's kind of crazy. It's obviously, people are buying them because they think they're going to be scarce, but Apple sold, like, what, 100 million iPods? I don't know why the... They're a hot product for a brand new one, because you can't buy a brand new one from Apple anymore, right? But there's probably, 50,000 unopened iPod Classics out there at different various retailers. And I don't know, but it seems to be a hot item right now, which is just mind-boggling to me. Look, I have an iPod Classic. Well, it's not technically an iPod Classic. It's a classic iPod. The distinction being there was an actual iPod Classic product line from Apple for the last few years. Well, I've got it's either a fifth or a sixth generation iPod, the original like iPod. Actually, I have an original iPod as well from 2001, and it still works, believe it or not. I had a conversation with someone over Skype a couple weeks ago, and he brought up his iPods, and I brought mine out, and I have the original. He had like the U2 one, which was all black with a red dial on it. Well, I've got the original iPod with the mechanical click wheel and all that, FireWire 400 for charging. And, it's been sitting in a drawer for me for 6-7 years, completely unused. I don't even remember the last time I synced it. And the Mac I have right now, none of my current Macs have even a FireWire 400 port. But my daughter has a MacBook with a FireWire 400. I found a cable, I plugged it in. After about 5 minutes, it turned itself on and started charging. It worked great. So, I don't know. It's a crazy thing. A canceled project, a product at Apple, and they're exploding in online sales. People really, really want these. The one I've got, though, is all black. I replaced the hard drive in it a number of years ago with there was these kits I bought at OWC at the time. Remember, I wasn't an employee back then. I bought this at OWC. It came with a 250 gig hard drive and the little tool kit to take apart my iPod. And I did it. I took it apart. I installed this new hard drive in it. I plugged it into my Mac at the time. The Mac saw it. I formatted it. I synced it. 250 gigs. So all the music I own is on that one iPod. And occasionally, I still do sync it when I've added new music. Probably maybe once every 6-7 weeks. I'll plug it into my Mac and charge it up and sync the new music to it. I don't use it hardly ever, but I have been doing a lot of traveling, and it's really nice to have all your music with you when you're traveling, sitting in a hotel room, nothing to watch, you didn't bring any movies, the Wi-Fi is terrible, so you're not going to really browse the internet. Break out the headphones, break out the classic iPod, hit on shuffle, and it's great. I love it. I always try to rate my music, the 1 through 5 stars in iTunes. Because I have so much music, there's just no way for me to keep on top of that. But it's kind of nice that I have one playlist that's called No Rating, which is a smart playlist in iTunes that has all the music that I've never rated. Now, once I give something a star rating, it gets out of that playlist because it's rated at that point. So occasionally I'll actually, either on my Mac or on my iPod Classic, or my classic iPod, I will go to that playlist and just shuffle through it and just sit there and start rating songs. I don't usually get too far because I'll hear a song and I'll listen to it all the way through, and there's 3.5-4 minutes. Instead of starting a song, oh, I like this one, this is a 3, and the next one, that's a 4, the next one, that's a 2, the next one, how the heck did the Barney theme song get on my... Yes, I actually do have the Barney theme song in my iTunes library. I could probably delete it now because my 7-year-old, who I originally got it for, you play Barney to him, it's like a punishment. But I, you know, there was a time that he wanted to hear Barney when we were in the car. So, of course, I had it on my iPhone. I had it on my iPod. And, you know, you listen to Barney. You listen to Dora the Explorer music. That's what you do as a dad or a mom. You know, the little ones want to hear that kind of music. That's what you play for them. It makes them happy. And when you're in the car, you want them happy. So I kind of have my own little personal thing. If anything is rated 1 star, it gets deleted out of my library. Because 1 star to me means, ugh, I never want to hear this again. I don't like this song. It's a 1 star. A two star is something that, you know what, I might want to hear this again, but probably not very often. So I'll rate it 2 stars, and then of course it goes up. But if it's 1 star, I delete it. The reason I do that is I just have so much stuff in my iTunes library. To find what I want to delete is very difficult. So if I'm going to that no rating playlist, shuffling through, and I find a song I know for a fact that I want to delete, like the Barney song, for instance, the Barney theme song. Barney, by the way, for those who don't know, it's the Purple Dinosaur Barney. You know, the I love you, you love me, that song. That's the one I'm talking about. So I'll rate it with a 1 star. But usually I'll do that here when I'm not at home in front of the Mac, because if I'm at home and I don't like it, I'll just hit the delete key and it's gone forever. But if I'm on the road or I'm listening to music on my iPod, I can't delete it from my iTunes library from, you know, that device. Excuse me. Yes, I've got a cold. It's kind of affecting my voice right now. I don't know if you can really hear it or not, but I can feel it. It's getting a little scratchy. But that's a good way when you're on the road, if you want to start weeding out songs like that. And it works for me. That way, the next time I sync it, if I don't remember right away to go and delete those songs, eventually I'll do a sort of the ratings in iTunes, and I'll scroll down until I find the 1 star ratings, and boom, just they're gone forever at that point. It's a good way of doing it. Do you do anything similar like that? How do you keep your iTunes library manageable? It's so difficult. You know, there's... I've got so many songs in my library, not because I purchased every one through the iTunes store, that's ridiculous, but I used to do website design, and one of those websites that I did was for a local record company. You know, they sold CDs, cassettes, those kind of things, and I did it for over 5 years, but they didn't pay me. What they did was they gave me a free CD a week. And that was cool with me. I was young. It was, you know, I was much younger. And it wasn't a very complex website. You know, once a month or if that, I would update their top 10 lists, and that was about it. It was pretty much a static page. In exchange for my probably 20 hours of building the website by hand, because there was no WordPress and stuff like that at the time, hey, free CDs. Now, free CDs sound cool when you're, you know, 25, 26 years old. Not so cool when you're 35 years old and, hey, I have bills to pay. But at the time, it went on my resume. It looked good. And free music. Well, when hard drives became big enough and iTunes was kind of a thing, I ripped all of those CDs to my computer. I didn't get selective. I didn't say, hey, I wanted just these 4 songs off this CD and these 5 songs off this one. I just ripped the whole CDs. And so a lot of music. Think about it. One CD, that's 52 CDs a year. Now multiply that by, you know, 4 or 5 years, you're talking a lot of CDs, which means a lot of music that... It got to the point where I'm like, I have no idea what came out this week. Yeah, I haven't even heard it. Just go ahead and give me that CD. I mean, I was literally running out of things that's... I remember one song off one movie. I kind of liked it. I guess I'll get that CD this week. So you get a lot of stuff that you're not going to enjoy I have no idea why I got it, but I had to pick a CD, and that's the one I picked that week. And years later, it's all in my iTunes library. But anyways, there's a lot of people right now looking to buy gifts. It's the holiday season for a lot of people out there. A lot of people are looking to buy something for their loved ones, for their friends, for their family, for the coworkers. Well, if you've got a tech person in your world and you want to go that route, we've got some great deals going on up at OWC right now. Cyber savings continues. Now, here's the thing, though. As I record this, it's Tuesday. The show will probably go live Wednesday and Thursday. And if you're listening to this on Thursday, it's, you know, Christmas is a week away. You need to get your orders placed and so it can get to you on time to make its way under the Christmas tree. Now, obviously, these prices are good for everybody. So if you don't celebrate the holidays, Christmas, you could still take advantage of these savings. And there's amazing savings going on right now. I've been posting a lot of these up on Twitter and Facebook, and the response has been just crazy. Apple Genuine Earbuds, $4.50. The little white ones that came with the iPods, $4.50. Right now, limited supply. So if you're curious and you want to learn more, go to maxsales.com. If you want to get this deal, though, you got to jump on it soon. These will not last forever. I mean, we've got a Uniden earbuds right now with a built-in line microphone, so you can use it with your iPhone. $2.75. That's saving $17.20. I mean, it's huge savings right now. Now, these prices are only good for this week. So, you know, at the end of this week, if, you know, the prices are going to change. That's just the way retail goes. And if you want the savings, you got to jump on them while they're there. You can get right now a 1 terabyte on-the-go hard drive from OWC for $139. That's a great deal. Do you need a little dual flash drive? We've got them, 32 gigs, $1,750. I mean, just amazing deals. 3 terabyte mini stack from NewerTech, $149 right now. Do you still need to be able to read DVDs? We've got an external OWC Slim, $37. So I'm not going to go through everything here, but there's some amazing deals right now, including used Macs. That's the thing that I'll post a link to the used Macs, and wow, it gets retweeted and people jump all over those. So if you're in the market for a used Mac starting at $129, now's the time to grab it. Again, these prices are not going to last forever. By the way, the $129 one, that's an iMac 17-inch Core Duo, 1.83 gigahertz. Right now, $129. We got a great conversation coming up with Gareth. I think you guys are going to like this, of course, as I'm doing with everybody, the three random questions. He really stumbled over the first one. So as I get into the three random questions, ask yourself what your answer would be. That's the fun part. What would your answer to these random questions be? And usually it's going to be different for everybody, but I think it's fun. I know Gareth was a little frustrated that he couldn't come up with a name. He actually said, you might have to edit this. No, that's the great part. When someone doesn't know the answer or can't come up with an answer to a question like that, hearing them work through it, that's what I love. I think that's fun. I have a question for you, and I ask because this actually comes up with the during the conversation. It's about printers. Do you still need a printer? Do you still use a printer? I just got rid of a laser printer, a Lexmark laser printer that I've had for 8 to 10 years. I mean, maybe longer, maybe 12 years. I've had this laser printer forever. And I used it quite a bit, and I only had to change the toner one time. But, you know, it was taking so much room on the shelf here on my desk. And it's big, and it was just a dust collector. But it worked fine. we were never using it. So we got rid of it. But do you still have a need for a printer? I bet you have one still. How often do you print with it? I really would like to know. I'm curious. You know, printers, at least for me, I remember when that was a big deal. That was a big purchase. Is it still? I mean, I see them when I'm at Best Buy or Office Depot. In fact, I was at Staples yesterday, and I just happened to go through, or no, 2 days ago, and I happened to go through the aisle where they had all the printers, and I kind of slowed down and looked at them. But they all kind of looked the same to me. They were either a color laser printer, or they were a multifunction scanner, printer, fax machine, bagel maker. The last part was to see if you were paying attention. You know, I don't know how often people print anymore. I guess if you have legal documents, you need to print them out and sign them. There's been a few things that I've actually had to fax over the last year or so. Faxing. There's actually online services that you can use for faxing now. You upload the file and they fax it for you. Some of them are free, with limitations. Some of them cost like $1 a page. But who has a fax machine anymore? I don't. I barely use my scanner. I use my scanner, though, more than I use my actual printer. And the scanner that I use is just this all-in-one. It's an Epson 620. It's a good printer. It's a good scanner. The ink isn't too expensive on it. But we hardly ever use it. Do you use your printer? I'd love to know. And if you do, what do you print? OWCradio@macsales.com is the email address. Let me know. Give me your thoughts on printers. I really genuinely do want to know. Something else I want to know, for those with younger kids, do you turn on the parental controls on the Macs if you let your kids use them? I had my 11-year-old has her own laptop now. It's a white MacBook. It's a good machine. She likes it. But it was driving her crazy in that I gave her a restricted account, and I turned on pretty heavy parental controls. Now, she's a very, very responsible child. She really is. If she hears something on TV that's, in her words, a bad word, a curse word, she's immediately reaching for the remote to turn the channel because she knows she's not supposed to watch that. And she polices herself very, very well. And she'll come in and say, "Hey, Dad, can I look at this website?" And of course, let me take a look. But on the MacBook, if she tried to go to a website that she couldn't get to, she'd have to bring me the computer. I'd have to type in the administrator username and password and allow it. And I liked that for a while. And it's been like that for about a year. But just this past weekend, because she's shown so much maturity, I turned off the parental controls. Now, she doesn't keep this laptop in a room. It's always on my desk when she's not using it. She knows I have complete access to it. And I've told her, I said, you know, I'm going to be looking through your history of web browsing to make sure you're not going to bad websites that you're not supposed to. And she understands that. At 11 years old, you don't have any rights. You have the rights that I give you when it comes to web browsing. But I'm wondering, how do you handle that as a parent? Because you can't just hand an 8-year-old a laptop and say, go to town, right? There's just way too many things that you don't want an 8-year-old to get access to. But do you use the parental controls built into iOS or macOS? What do you use? How do you monitor what your kids are doing online? Do you have a family computer that's kind of in a public area, in the dining room, or in, I don't know. Let me know. I am very curious. In today's day and age of tablets, iPads, iPhones, laptops, how do you monitor what your kids are getting access to? I mean, I know some kids that are like 10 years old and less that have a Facebook account. My 11-year-old doesn't have a Facebook account. Number one, according to Facebook's own rules, they're too young and they're not supposed to have one. I don't remember the age that they say you have to be to get a Facebook account. I think it's like 14 or 15. But I won't let my 11-year-old have a Facebook account. But yet I've got some nephews and nieces who are much younger than her that do have them. I don't know. I don't know where I draw the line. Well, yeah, I do know where I draw the line. My 11-year-old's not having a Facebook account. That's where I draw the line. But the flip side of that is I turned off the parental controls on her laptop. So I'd love to hear from you. What do you think? What's your advice? There's no handbook for us parents out there. And for those of you who aren't a parent, I'd love to hear your opinion too. What do you think? Let me know. OWCRadio@maxsales.com. These are things that we all face. And hey, let's turn this into a forum to get some feedback from you guys. I really do want to know. It's frustrating sometimes. It's hard to find that kind of information and that kind of mature discussion about subjects like that, because it always breaks down to people say, you got to let them do what they want, that's the only way they learn, and other people saying, no, they shouldn't even touch electronics until they're 35, and the famous story of Steve Jobs won't let his own kids have iPads, which I thought was ridiculous, but, you know, we're all parents, and we all do it differently, but, you know, let's share some information. Maybe there's something we can learn from each other. But that's what's going on in our world right now. Parental controls have been lifted. Now, that doesn't mean the 7-year-old can get on there and start browsing the internet. He's not allowed. And I don't think he even wants to. He just wants to play video games. But again, OWCRadio@maxsales.com. So I'm going to wrap up this segment because I'm getting a frog in my throat again. I hate it when I don't feel good. And have you ever got a sty in your eye? I used to get them quite a bit when I was a kid, but then I haven't had them for years. Well, I've got one in my right eye right now. It's actually kind of affecting my vision in my right eye a little bit. It's making it a little blurry. And I've done the WebMD stuff, and I see most people don't go to a doctor for a sty, and supposed to put a warm compress on it, and that's what I'm going to do, I guess. But it's bugging me. If you're going to be in the Las Vegas area before we wrap up, I did want to remind you guys, we are going to be at CES. We're going to be in the Las Vegas Convention Center, South Hall, third floor, booth 30572. Next week, I'm going to talk about who we're going to have at our booth. It's going to be a scheduled event every day, twice a day in our booth, and we're going to have some giveaways at CES as well. Excuse me again. Jeez, I apologize for that. It's a podcast, so it's real life. You know what I mean? It's not canned. It's real life. And you can see us in real life. You like that transition back? At CES. Again, Las Vegas Convention Center, South Hall, booth 30572. And drop me an email, owcradio@maxsales.com, if you have any questions about our booth at CES, your parental stuff, how you handle that. What do you do with a printer? Do you even use one? Are you scanning? Are you faxing still? Let me know. I'd really like to know. And I'll share your answers right here on OWC Radio. So let's jump over to my conversation with Gareth. I hope you guys enjoy this. I know I had a whole lot of fun talking to him. And we'll see you guys in a week. Back here on OWC Radio, and like I was talking about at the beginning of the show, I've got a fun conversation today with Gareth Prosser. Hello, Gareth. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Tim. All is good in my world.
Good. Now, you're in Florida.
Correct. Down in Orlando, yeah.
Orlando, Florida. Well, that's, boy, you must go to the theme parks a lot.
yeah, maybe not.
No? When you live by them, it's not that big of a deal?
Exactly. It's the same old thing. You know, when you have it around you, you never use it.
Now, is there certain parts of town that you avoid because you know that's where all the tourists are coming through, going to the different areas down there?
Yeah, generally, all of us that live here, yeah, pretty much stay away from anything to do with the Disney area because now it's just sort of insane, especially this time of year.
Now, I have to say, you have a very thick Florida accent.
I know, it's good, isn't it? I was born in Alabama, yeah.
So where are you from?
Originally from London, actually. And we've been sort of transplanted in the US now since 1996 when I first came out here with a band. And then we went back to London for 2 years when I was doing some Blue Man stuff in London, and now back out to Florida.
So you are a producer, a composer, a guitarist, and a member of the Blue Man group. That's a lot of hats to wear.
It is quite a lot of hats, but strangely, they all sort of mold into one thing, which is just creativity.
Oh, absolutely. So let's start with guitarist. When did you first pick up the guitar?
Guitaring, I was age of 9, I believe.
Wow, that's pretty young. Yeah,
I specifically remember sitting in a Chinese restaurant with my parents eating food at the ripe old age of 9, declaring that guitar was going to be my thing.
Did you even have a guitar at that point?
No, I didn't. But I did have a drum. I'd had a drum kit, so.
So what was it about the guitar? I mean, was it a famous guitarist that you saw that you were like, "That's I want to be that guy," or was it a local thing?
Honestly, I think it was just, I loved music growing up. Music was always around the house. And my father was a drummer in a jazz quartet.
Really?
And my mother was a choral singer. So it was always around. And I just sort of felt like it was... I don't know. There was no real guitar hero at that point. I mean, that came pretty soon afterwards.
Sure.
But it really was the love of music. But I have to say, though, the first guitar teacher I had was absolutely appalling. So it was sort of really bad folk songs on acoustic guitar, which just didn't tweak my rock and roll muscle.
No. So I have to imagine if your parents have such a big musical background, my guess is they were pretty supportive when 9-year-old Gareth said, "I want to be a guitar player."
Oh, absolutely. Without question. Yeah. And to be honest, what more can you ask for as a kid?
No, absolutely.
I mean, it's just the best thing. And so, yeah, sort of the next day, I ended up with an acoustic guitar.
They took you down to the store and bought you one.
Yeah, that was it. And then, but I always remember when things sort of started to get more serious with music, the one thing they always said to me was, if you're going to do this, because it's such a sort of a tough industry to be in,
sure.
We'll support you all the way, but you've got to go to college and you've got to do it properly, because at least you have things to fall back on, like teaching and things like that, you know.
So they did instill that on you, have a backup plan.
Absolutely, yeah. But I mean, it was always a backup plan that was going to be based around music. You know, it was never a backup plan to go and be an accountant.
Now, did you actually end up using that backup plan at all? Did you ever teach?
Yeah, I have taught. Yeah, I mean, in London, I used to teach in schools. Actually, I would go in as a freelance guitar tutor, and teach sort of elementary through high school. And it was great because it was freelance. So I was never, I'd set my own timetable, and it was a great way for me to start earning a living when I left college as a musician.
Now, you said before we started recording that you have some boys, some kids.
Yeah, I do. I've got two boys. Yeah.
Two boys. Are they musically inclined?
They are, both of them. Yeah. They study with a great piano teacher locally. So,
now I hear a lot of people start on the piano and then kind of migrate to other instruments. Is it because piano, if you learn that discipline, it really does translate to other instruments well?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. You have the treble clef and the bass clef. So you've got both hands working in unison. And it's such a brilliant way to start. And, my sort of mantra is just do 2 years of piano lessons. And then if you want to go and play something else, play something else. But that foundation is just amazing.
So let's move up a little bit. Composer. Now, what do you compose? I mean, is it classical? Is it television? Is it movies? What are you composing?
Currently movies. I've just finished a score for a film called Grace, and that gets its US release on February 24th, 2015. And that was a movie score, quite sort of low key, very very minimal. Funnily enough, with some guitar and a little bit of orchestration. and then I got that film finished, and now I'm working on an adaptation of a graphic novel, which is called The Zombie Chronicles, and that graphic novel's been released, and we're working on a digital adaptation. So I'm writing the score for that at the moment.
A digital adaptation of a book. of a graphic novel.
It's actually quite interesting. It's sort of technology that's being developed. It's I suppose you could call it a sort of a motion graphic novel, really.
Yeah, I've seen those around.
It's the essence of the graphic novel, but with... So it's not fully animated, but it has motion, and it will be something that you could download onto your sort of, you know, iOS device and watch, you know, if you're commuting. And then obviously it'll have my score on there.
Now, when you're working on a project like that, do you talk with the artist and the writer and try to get their input on it? Or do you kind of look at the source material and go, I feel it should be this?
It generally it'll start with a conversation. I'll get the script of the dialogue for the sort of graphic novel. I'll read the graphic novel and then I'll start jotting a few ideas down, and then the director, producers will all sort of get together. And then what I like to do is sort of form a core of sounds that really is the essence of the project. So a sort of a template, if you like. So on the computer, then I'll build this core of sounds, instruments, whatever, sound design, and then that's it for the project. We all agree that that's the vibe we want, and we can go from there.
Wow. I wouldn't even know where to begin. I mean...
I've got, compared to a lot of composers, I've got quite a small template, but the template on this graphic novel I'm doing is... it's about 200 tracks.
Wow. that's a lot.
It is a lot, but compared to sort of, you know, major Hollywood composers, sure. It's about a quarter of that.
So what kind of a rig are you doing that on? What's your hardware look like?
The hardware is mainly a Mac Pro, 2013 Mac Pro.
Oh, you got one of the new ones.
Yeah. And
How do you like that new Mac Pro?
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
It's absolutely killer. I'll give you an example. When I'm running all those tracks, I'm running it in Logic Pro X, and I'm not even at 6% on the CPU meters.
Wow, even when you're playing it?
Even when I'm playing it, yeah.
Wow, that's a lot of power.
It's an awful lot of power, yeah. I mean, and I can keep the buffers set at 64, which means I can play instruments in real time without any latency.
And you don't mind not having a lot of internal storage, like on the older Mac Pros, where you could stick four drives in there?
No, not at all. Because I've always had external drives.
I saw your tweet, by the way, today. You're finally retiring some really old OWC hard drives.
I know those Mercuries, and their IDE. They're the IDE versions.
Right.
Have been brilliant since I think it was 2003 or 2004. And they're 250 gigabytes, and they were my sample library drives.
250 gigs. When you bought those, that was how could you ever fill that up?
I know they were, and I think those when I bought them, they were the biggest drives that were made by OWC at that point.
I had some of those drives back then with that kind of that translucent clear plastic case.
Yeah.
Yep, I loved them. I had mine sitting vertically on a desk. I had two of them as well.
Yeah.
And they were my backup. Those are good drives, but you got 11 years out of them, 10 years out of them. That's a long time for any hard drive.
It's not bad, is it? I mean, what I realized, you know, it was about 2 weeks ago when they started to get they started to slow down. And I sort of thought, you know what? It's time. And I have plenty of other drives, but I've kept them there because they've been going strong. And I see no reason to get rid of stuff if it's not working.
Oh, I'm totally with you. I like the latest and greatest toys. I mean, I've got the new iPad, I've got the new iPhone 6 Plus, and I love them. But yeah, there's something about the older technology when it just works. Why replace it? I'll give you a prime example. I just got rid of a laser printer that I've had for 12 years,
right.
and it worked great. It was just I wasn't printing anything on it anymore, and it was taking up so much space on my desk. I thought, why do I have this big laser printer? And I've been saying that for a couple of years now, and I would think, but it works fine. Why do I need to get rid of it? I'm not going to replace it with anything, but it was finally time to get rid of it. So sometimes you do have to move on, but if things work, why mess with it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we sort of live in a society where it's really easy now to just sort of ditch something and get the next best thing. And, you know, I mean, I have to rely on a system that is stable. And once I've got a system that's solid and functioning perfectly, I really keep it for a long time because I can't afford to be in a position where I change something and it totally messes the system up because I've got deadlines.
Right. Absolutely. That's money.
Yeah, totally. It kills me. If anything goes south on the system, I'm done.
So you're also a producer. What does that entail?
Producer entails, well, for me, the producing records.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I came to the US originally was my band from England was signed to A&M Records. And that project, for me, I was the producer of the album. And then producer of an album on Columbia Records for the same band.
Were you in the band?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a guitarist and a co-writer.
So that's a lot of hats to wear in a band, too.
It is. But it's great fun. But the thing is, I think ultimately, when you write music and you're sort of very intimate to it, you know the sound you want. And if you work with people that sort of respect that and don't try and take control, they're able to hand over the reins to you and say, okay, you know your sound, why don't you produce it?
But that's pretty rare for a record label to do that, isn't it?
It is quite rare, but we had a very, very strong sense of ourselves. And, you know, it was at a time when a label was still, it was flexible enough to say, okay, you know, you can produce this. But we did, I mean, to be fair, on the second record, we had Andy Wallace mix it. And Andy Wallace has done, you know, everything from Jeff Buckley to Linkin Park and beyond. And I was fortunate enough to be able to sort of sit in the studio while Andy was mixing.
Was that weird for you, though?
Was it weird? No, not at all, because I feel, you know, when you sit in a studio with someone with those sort of credits, or anybody really, you can always learn something. So it's never weird. For me, it's a learning experience.
Yeah, a lot of people look at it that way, I think. And that's the people that are more successful when they could kind of put their ego to a side and say, wow, this person really knows this stuff. I'm going to sit here quietly and observe and absorb everything I can.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's not a lot of people could do that, though.
Yes, honestly, it's humility, and it takes time to learn that, definitely. Yeah.
How do you teach your kids that?
well,
I really want to know. I'm trying to teach a 7 and an 11-year-old.
Yeah, I'll get back to you in about 5 years' time and let you know if it worked out.
Oh, so what is Tin Pig Music? By the way, it's an awesome name.
Yeah, Tin Pig Music is just the name for my sort of business, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it came from a Celtic pig or boar that was given to me by my wife many, many years ago as something that whenever I went on tour.
You got to explain that.
Well, because our backgrounds, her family sort of emanated from Wales and Ireland. And so that's the Celtic side. And part of my family is Welsh, and my mother's Danish.
Okay.
So we've got sort of Vikings and Celts. So we had this kind of, I don't know, it's just, it was a good, just a good thing.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's great. So I got to know where the Blue Man Group comes into play, because everybody listening to this has heard of the Blue Man Group. They're performing artists. I've never actually seen them in person, but I do know people who have. They've been around for a very long time now, 20 years? 25 yeah. years. It's one of those things that I think, oh, I would love to go see them perform live. What do you do in the Blue Man Group, and how did you get involved with them?
Blue Man Group for me has been a gig of mine since 2005.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, I got to a point where I'd been spent a lot of time in tour buses with my own band, and I just sort of got to a point where I thought I need some time away, but I don't want to give up live performance. And Blue Man Group came about, and it's one of those things, you know, when you're sort of on the scene as a musician, you get to know people, and this opportunity came up, and it worked out, and so I went over at that point we were living in New York. And I went over then to Berlin to train on the show in Berlin, played the show there, and then we came back to New York, and then I got sent to London to open the show in London, which was hometown for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then the show closed, and then the day the show closed, the next day I was on a plane to Orlando to do the Orlando show.
Did you fall in love with the Orlando area? Is that why you stayed?
Yeah, honestly, it took a while because Orlando was never, ever on my radar.
No, I can imagine. Very humid.
Very, and it just, and also all I ever knew about it was theme parks. And, you know, I just didn't want to be around theme parks. But interestingly enough, once you get into the fabric of living somewhere, I'm a great believer in it. You know, you can live somewhere and be miserable, or you can live somewhere and get into the fabric of it and be happy.
And every place is different. And if you don't acclimate to yourself to the area, you're never going to be happy.
Exactly. And so I think, you know, you just have to go with a really open mind. And we did. And it's been a great gig for me. And I get to play pretty much every night.
You play music every night.
Yeah, I get to play live every night. You know, and our theater's 1,000-seater. So.
And now this is with the Blue Man Group?
Yep.
So you have a show almost every night.
Yeah, I do sort of 5 to 7 shows a week. Yeah.
So what do you do in the group?
I am a string player. So I get to play. We have this custom built instrument called an electric zither, and it's basically a 96 string tabletop guitar.
96 strings?
Yeah, it's a vast. It's a beast.
I was going to say, how do you play something that big?
Yeah, well, you sit down at it, you look at it, and hope for the best. it really is. It took a long time to get it under control. If people sort of search for it online, the electric zither, it is an incredible instrument, and it's essentially a giant guitar. And you can create a really, really wide range of sounds. You know.
Now, do you have to do the whole makeup and everything too?
Yeah, when we're on stage, there's the 3 Blue Men and then 4 band members, and we're all on stage together. And I wear, for me, I'm under ultraviolet light, so I'm wearing ultraviolet sort of tribal face paint.
What's that like, having to put on that every night?
Yeah, it's easy. Is it easy? It's nothing compared to the grease paint of the Blue Men.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, I don't know how they could wear that. That would drive me crazy.
That's definitely a rough one.
Yeah, I don't even like to put on mosquito repellent. I don't I don't like that stuff on my skin.
It would be the equivalent of you basically layering tons of Vaseline all over your head.
Now, do they actually shave their heads, or do they wear something to go over their hair?
Essentially it's a bald cap.
Now, kids love the Blue Man Group. They have a children's museum in Grand Rapids, Michigan that... the organization behind the Blue Man Group came in and put this whole pipe thing together, and kids can bang on it. And it's one of the most popular attractions at this museum. And it reinforces my belief that everybody, whether they actually have skill or not, are musically inclined.
I agree. I think all you have to do is, you know, you just have to unlock it in that person. It's there.
Absolutely. I agree.
And it'll take whatever, and it may not necessarily, for example, be formal piano lessons or formal any lessons. I think the idea of creativity, which is what it is to allow that child or that person to have a go at something, and suddenly they'll find it and it will click.
Now, every person that I speak with nowadays on OWC Radio, I have 3 random questions. So I'm going to give you a little bit of time to prepare yourself for that, because these are completely random questions. I don't prepare them per person. So when we get to that, be ready. I'm not giving you any more hints on what the questions are than that.
Okay.
So you were a radio producer at ABC Radio.
Correct. Yeah, I did all the action sports radio stuff. So ESPN Action Sports Podcast. EXPN Radio and the EXPN Radio long form show, which was a weekend countdown show based on a top 20 interspersed with sort of action sports celebrities.
How did that come about?
That came about from actually being in the band, funnily enough.
Really?
A guy at ABC Radio in New York was a big fan.
What was the name of the band, by the way? We haven't said that.
The band was called Fat, F-A-T. Mm-hmm. And some people might remember there was a band in England called Madness. And
I remember Madness.
Yeah, well, myself and Woody and a couple of other guys basically put Fat together. and then went from there. And Woody still does Madness. He's the drummer in Madness. They do a lot in the UK. And that was it. That was the band formed in London, and then we came over to the US, as I said, on A&M Records.
Do you still get together with them at all, or is the band no longer around?
No, we're all doing our own sort of things. The singer is a DJ on iHeartRadio. the bass player is, I think, living in Spain, I think. And then Woody's obviously doing Madness, and I'm here, you know, in my world of composition and everything else.
So is that desire to still, I mean, does Blue Man Group kind of get that itch for you to perform live, or do you ever think, man, it would be kind of neat to put a band together? But I mean, you know, you're not a young man anymore. You can't live on the road like you used to. You've got a family.
Yeah.
But do you still have that itch?
Now, honestly, the itch is thoroughly scratched.
Yeah. With Luna.
It really is. I mean, it's a great situation because I can go in the evening, do sound check, do the shows, and then my day I can really just dedicate to the composing and producing.
And you work from home most of the time?
Yeah, I have a studio built at home. Yep.
So you say a studio? I take it was a bedroom or an attic, or what was it originally?
Well, it's actually built out over the garage.
So it's okay.
An extension of the garage. Let's clarify studio. It's a writing room.
Okay. I gotcha.
I can record a little bit. I can record live here. If I need to do a sort of small instruments, that's fine. But if ever I want to do anything, you know, larger than that, I go to an external studio and then bring everything back here to edit.
So what has technology done for your career? I mean, how much has it changed over the past, say, 2 decades and where you're at now, and where do you see it going? But let's start where, how much it has changed for you.
What it's done for me is allowed me to set up a writing space at my house and pretty much emulate, you know, everything I need to, from orchestral writing to small ensemble writing. With the advent of the sort of sample libraries and being able to stream those libraries off extremely fast drives, it's glitch-free writing, really. And it's opened up a palette of colors of music that would you could only have dreamt about this because you would have had to go to a studio, you would have had to hire a bunch of people to try things out. But now it's all here, and it's all on SSDs, on drives.
Yeah, and it's right there for you.
I know. Brilliant. Yeah,
I was watching John Gruber at Daring Fireball linked to a YouTube video of, I'm drawing a blank on the person's name now, but it was a guy who did the original sound design in Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And it's like a 5-minute clip, and he's basically showing how he put this sound together for the Millennium Falcon's engines failing in the Star Wars movie. And it's all on tape, and he's pushing these big, huge buttons on a console and adjusting it, and tapes are rewinding and going forward. And it really kind of hit me that you could do all of that on a MacBook Air. It's nothing now. Everything he was doing to craft the sound, which was brilliant, don't get me wrong, is so much simpler now.
Mm.
You know, that technology is in the hands of everybody. And yet, even though it is in the hands of everybody, it's still the people that have actual talent that can do something with it.
Mm.
You know?
Without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, I think it's great. It's great that people can have it sort of on their MacBook Air, for example, and sort of tinker around. But you know, there comes a point when it's experience and talent and dealing with many different situations that get you to a point of being able to really create and work to deadlines and know what you're doing without sort of fumbling around and going, oh, maybe if I cut and paste this, I wonder what will happen. It's, you need to know what's going to happen.
Right.
It's what I call sort of creative decision making.
Do you think the technology is allowing people to fulfill their dreams easier now than they would have in the past? I mean, the entry to barrier is so much smaller than it used to be.
I think it is on a personal level, but I think the danger is I've seen an entitlement coming forward with people saying, well, I've got this gear, so surely I should be making a living with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the dangerous aspect. It's not, it's still, you still got to work your butt off, and you've got to go up through the ranks, work with the right people, gain the knowledge of working with people more experienced than yourself. It's not a pathway of entitlement to suddenly, you know, being a star.
So the technology is not doing away with paying your dues.
Oh, I don't think, personally, I don't think so.
No, I agree. From everybody I've talked to in the past, and I bring up, I don't ask it in exactly the same way, but the answer is usually the same. Those who are successful, whether it's moderately or wildly successful, they all say the same thing. You have to pay your dues.
Mm.
And the technology is, it lowers the barrier to entry, but not to success. You still have to pay your dues to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it does. It facilitates this sort of idea of creativity and being creative, but absolutely. You know, there is no shortcut. You know,
when you're writing music, do you see the notes that you're writing, or do you hear them as you're writing them?
Generally, I'll hear them. It starts with a sort of an oral concept, and then I'll tinker around, probably on the piano downstairs. Or I'll just launch straight into a template that I've set up for that project. And I'll know, for example, I know that I want strings to play a certain pattern or line, or horns to do something. So then I'll launch straight in. And that's the beauty of the technology now, that I can have that sort of sound palette set up, and look at it and go, oh, I know what sound I want there. I don't have to sort of write it out musically, on a notepad.
Right.
It's there, it's instant.
Writing music to me is magical. I really can hear it when it's all put together, but the way people can just create it and hearing all the different layers in the music. And you said something earlier, it's like seeing colors.
Yeah.
I don't know how you guys do it. I really don't. It's magical to me. And I've got a lot of respect for anybody who can do that, because, you know, I'm the beneficiary of your hard work. I'm the one that gets to listen to it. And, you know, when I listen to music, I don't think, well, how do they do that? And how do they know to put this here? It just kind of all comes together at once in my ear. When you're writing it, do you already hear the completed thing and you have to then go back and put all the pieces together? Or is it, as you're doing it, it's coming together?
It mainly comes together as I'm sort of moving along. Very rarely would you wake up in the morning, for me personally, and say, right, I've got it all. I've got those, you know, 200 tracks. It's all there. it's a process of really, I go back to the colors, of the idea of the feel and sort of looking at the picture I'm working to and thinking, you know, is that dark, is that light? And then it all sort of comes together. It's honestly, you know, there are, you know, you study formally, I studied music formally, and there are many rules, but ultimately it always goes back to, you know, does it sound good? Does it sound right?
Right. So, what is the First Institute?
The First Institute is a production school based in Orlando. And it's, yeah, teaches everything, actually, everything to do with the media sort of business, from filmmaking to sound design to sound editing to music production, music recording, engineering. It's a sort of a full order sort of a production school, really.
And you're an academic advisor there.
That's correct.
So,
yeah.
So what do you do?
These schools sort of need accreditation, formally. And so what a group of us do, the academic advisors, we go in a couple of times a year for meetings, and the school tells us what their sort of prospectus is, what they want to do within their courses. And then we all look at it and we say, you know, that's going to work. Or have you thought about teaching this? And, you know, different aspects of the tuition that will help the students. And they basically use, you know, people with experience who can say, you know, if a student learns this, that's going to help them in the real world.
Awesome.
It's not just a, not just a kind of a fake degree hoping that you'll get a job at the end. It's really kind of practical academic advice and training.
So you're passing it on. Everything that you've learned in your experience, you're passing on to the next generation.
Yeah, I hope so.
You hope so, yeah. So what's, of looking back of everything you've done, nothing that's like within the last 6 months, because that's kind of cheating. I think most people fall in love with whatever they're doing right now. But looking back, what's been your favorite musical project you've ever worked on?
Looking back, well, I mean, it would have to be the records I did with the band Fat, because we, you know, we had such a great time, and it was a really free reign to go into the studios, write, record, and produce, work with just brilliant engineers. And I had an executive producer who oversaw the project. It was a guy called Rick Wake, and Rick had a brilliant resume. He was responsible for bringing Celine Dion to the US.
Wow, really?
And he produced one of his first production gigs was Taylor Dane, and it went from there to Mariah Carey to all these sort of female singers. But with our band, he just let us go. It was like, you know, in your early 20s, what more could you ask for?
Right. Was it like you thought it was going to be like when you got there?
Oh, absolutely. I had a vision, you know, after I left London and sort of done my music college, and I'd been doing some sessions in London, and then the band formed, and it really was everything I thought it would be. being in just brilliant studios in New York City, and then sort of going out on the road. And I knew being on the road initially in a young band would be hard work, and it absolutely was. It was horrifically hard work with the drives, but I got, you know, I sort of saw 42 states, and what an amazing experience.
So what do you tell someone starting out in either, I mean, so many things that you do, producer, composer, a guitarist, a member of the Blue Man Group. If somebody wants to start out in any one of those things, they see a group like the Blue Man Group that they want to be a part of, or they want to become a composer or a producer, what's the first bit of advice you give them?
First bit of advice I would say is experiment. And find what unlocks your creativity, be it an instrument, be it a computer program. And don't worry about going to college, a formal education straight away. You need to find your passion. And once you found your passion, the gates will open then. Because ultimately with what we do, it's about really dedicating your sort of your whole self to it. You know, don't let anyone say to you, you know, oh, that's probably not the right thing to do. No, you know, there is no right or wrong way. You just have to find that thing that unlocks your creativity, and everything will unravel after that.
Don't chase the paycheck.
Yeah, don't. Because honestly, especially in creativity, you should never start out with that in mind. You know, the danger is people look at reality TV shows and they look at people that have zero talent and are making truckloads of money, and everyone suddenly thinks they can be a star.
You think those things are doing more harm to the creative community than helping?
I think they're great for the creative community, for the people who are working on them.
Excuse me.
I think they're brilliant for the people that are working on them from a production point of view. I think for the mass media, I think it's just crap.
Yeah. You know, most professionals I talk to that I've asked that same question have said the same thing. There's just no shortcuts in life, is there?
No, not at all.
All right, Gareth, it's time. I gave you a warning.
Yeah, I know.
It's time for the three random questions.
Right.
You know, I'm going to need to create a little bumper for that in the show moving forward. Like, yeah. A dun dun dun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Number one, and again, I don't tailor these to the person. They're just completely three random questions. What movie, in your opinion, deserves a sequel? Obviously, you have to pick a movie that isn't a sequel itself. Like, you can't say, well, Godfather 4, obviously.
That's right. Oh, what movie deserves a sequel?
I mean, there's a lot of great, great movies that never had a sequel, like Goodfellas, for instance. It's not an easy one, is it?
That's a shocker. That's a real shocker.
And this is to, I'm asking someone who composes music for movies and stuff.
I know. What, you know, I'm mentally picturing my sort of DVD Blu-ray collection and thinking.
Well, what's your favorite movie? If you had to sit down and watch something right now, something that you've already seen, what is that movie?
Oh, it would have to be right this second. It would have to be The Italian Job.
Oh, good movie. Now, they remade that, what, 3 times now? They keep remaking it.
I know. But you always have to go back to the Michael Caine version.
Absolutely. Now, he's still with us. Do you think The Italian Job with Michael Caine deserves a sequel? Would that be something you'd want to go watch?
No. No, because that film is I set it on a mantle, and it, where it is and where it lives is perfect for me.
Oh, it's a perfect movie. It's so fun. So the car chases in that movie are fantastic.
That's brilliant. I tell you, you know, I had the privilege of seeing Lawrence of Arabia on in its original form, the super wide format.
Wow.
And that was awesome, that film.
So you're still looking for a sequel.
I'm still looking for a sequel.
You know, I think that the problem is our favorite movies that aren't sequels themselves. You almost don't want to ruin it with a sequel.
I know. I just, yeah. Oh, you've killed me on this one. You killed me. I just, you know, what was I watching the other day? Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. Guy Ritchie film.
Yeah.
What else would deserve a sequel?
It's not an easy question.
No, I just, you might have to, you might have to edit this because I could be here ages.
No, I sometimes think it's great if they can't answer the question. That also says something about people.
Yeah, it's just, I'm, what else am I?
And people at home are in their cars driving to work, listening to this. They're all thinking the same thing now. Oh, what would I choose if I was asked that question? What movie deserves a sequel?
What movie deserves a sequel? God, there are so many singular movies that, like you said, deserve to be just a single cut.
I used to think that of what was that movie? ID4, that big action flick with Will Smith. I really liked that movie. Mm. When it came out, and I know they're making sequels to it now, and I'm like, no. That was just a fun, dumb movie the way it was. It doesn't need a sequel. It was fine the way it was.
Yeah. You know, actually, I would love to see what happened after Blade Runner.
Ooh. They're also making a sequel of that. Yes, Harrison Ford was just talking about he read the script for the Blade Runner Part 2, I guess, and he says it's the best screenplay he's ever written, ever read.
Oh no!
Yeah. Well,
there we go. I would have said Blade Runner, but it's being made. So
mine is The Breakfast Club.
Right.
I always wanted to know, not necessarily the next day or anything. I wanted to pick the story up of those characters. 20 or 30 years later, where do they end up? Because I think they would all be totally different than the way they were in high school. I know I am. Most people are. But yeah, it's not an easy question. Ready for number 2? This one would be a lot easier. I promise. What is your favorite restaurant?
My favorite restaurant is probably... Well, it's Indian food,
mm-hmm.
So it's a curry, and I'm.
Do you fall in love with the Indian food in London?
Yeah,
I know there's absolutely. A lot of it.
There's an awful lot of it, yeah, and it was kind of, you know, it's sort of what we sort of grew up on in a sense that going to college, you know, it was a quality pint of beer and an Indian meal.
Absolutely.
I can't. There was actually one also in New York when we lived there. Was it Tabla? But it'd be curry anyway.
Okay. Last random question. And this will probably be an interesting one from you, I think, because of your diverse background. Who is the most famous person you have met? Now, famous is kind of a misleading because famous to who? The general population, most famous to you?
Yeah.
You know?
That's a tough one because it's relative to what you do, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. As a producer and a music guy, it could be someone like Quincy Jones. As a radio, having worked in radio, it could have been someone like Howard Stern. I mean, it depends on, in your opinion, who was the most famous person you met, the person that you saw and that you got to meet and you thought, I can't believe I just met that person, or that was amazing. I wish somebody would have taken my picture with him or her.
Okay, you ready for this?
I am.
Alex Lifeson and Geddy Lee of Rush.
Oh, good choice. Absolutely. Did you actually have a conversation with them?
I had the privilege of meeting them backstage at the Amway Center in Orlando 2 years ago.
Oh, that's a good one.
And that blew my mind because I grew up as the biggest Rush fan. And when I had that opportunity, I was like a child.
That's awesome.
Yep.
There was a post, Dave Hamilton of the Mac Observer. He took a picture at a hockey game, I think. And for whatever reason, the time on the clock or scores or something, whatever it was 21-12.
Right.
But it was such little numbers, and it was this big board with all these numbers. And all he says was, for those who get it. And it took me all of 5 seconds looking at it going, what? I don't understand. 21-12. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And I was the first one who got that. So Rush, they were a great band. They still are. Are they still doing really new music?
I think they're sort of always writing, but they will always go out on tour because their live fan base is just huge.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I do remember actually on that note, I was interviewed in Guitar World magazine a while ago, and because they knew I was such a huge Alex Lifeson fan, they put my interview next to an interview with him in the magazine. And it was even sort of small things like that make a grown man happy.
Absolutely. Yeah, we all have to have heroes, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah. It's all about, the beauty of dreaming.
Absolutely. If they approach you and say, we really do need to add a fourth member, how fast would you leave Blue Man Group?
that would be faster than they could. The locker would be clean.
Would you want to get that close to your heroes, if you will?
Now, yeah.
Yeah?
In the early days, no. There would have been a glass wall, and I would have been happy to stay behind that.
I'm with you totally. I had the opportunity, when I first started podcasting, within the first 3 years, to interview Steve Wozniak, and I turned it down because I have so much respect for him. And I was just like, I don't know. I just didn't feel like I could bring anything new to an interview with Steve Wozniak. And I didn't want to do the interview unless I had something that I could really bring.
Yeah.
And now, sure, totally. I'd have him on the show in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
But I think that's confidence. It's when you get to a certain station in life, where you know who you are and you're confident and comfortable of what you're doing, I think things change. And I think that's called wisdom, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's wisdom. And also one thing you said earlier is, you set your own personal ego and agenda aside.
Yeah.
And that takes a bit of time to really build sort of that humility and say, you know what, I can talk to this person and not analyze myself, which is, narcissistic.
Absolutely. Gareth, I want to thank you for being on OWC Radio, and I want to wish you and your family a happy holidays. And thanks a lot for coming on.
Much appreciated, Tim. It was an absolute blast.